From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscowane, filling in for Terry Gross. The new movie Outbreak opens today at theaters. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear about a real outbreak that occurred at a Virginia research laboratory. Richard Preston brought it to the public's attention in The New Yorker and later in his book, The Hot Zone. The virus didn't cause a human epidemic, but it came frighteningly close. And why the destruction of the rainforest in the Amazon is threatening to snuff out the mystical practices of tribal healers. We talk with ethnobotanist Mark Plotkin about the plants and the medicine men of the tropical rainforest. Also, music critic Milo Miles reviews two anthologies, both from big band blues master Bobby Blue Bland. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Labor Department says unemployment fell 0.3% in February to 5.4%. That's the best level in 4 years. 318,000 jobs were created. President Clinton says the figures show his administration's economic plan has paid off.
As of today, the economy has produced 6.1 million jobs since I became president. And if Michael Jordan goes back to the Bulls, it'll be 6,100,001 new jobs.
The reference is to basketball star Michael Jordan. He's formally announced his retirement from baseball. There are rumors he will play again for the Chicago Bulls, his former team, but Jordan's made no announcement to that effect. President Clinton has forwarded the nomination of ex-Congressman Dan Glickman to the Senate. He's been nominated to head the Agriculture Department. UPI's Bill Small reports.
White House Press Secretary Mike McCurry says the Glickman nomination was delayed 2.5 months after it was announced because, in his words, we do it right. Although reports had said the delay was because the FBI's background check questioned the use of Glickman's congressional telephone credit card by his daughter. McCurry says the nomination should face no problems.
We're satisfied that he will receive confirmation from the Senate and go to work promptly. We've had good conversations with both Chairman Lugar and with Senator Leahy.
Within minutes of the White House announcement, Agriculture Committee Chairman Richard Lugar announced Glickman's confirmation hearing will begin the 21st of this month. Bill Small at the White House.
The estate of Dr. David Gunn is suing a Pensacola abortion opponent, claiming he is indirectly responsible for the doctor's murder. Debbie Elliott has this report.
David Gunn's father has filed a wrongful death lawsuit against anti-abortion activist John Burt and Rescue America. The suit claims Burt, regional director of Rescue America, led a conspiracy through violent means that encouraged Michael Griffin to take violent actions. Griffin is serving a life prison sentence for the murder of Dr. Gunn, who was shot to death as he arrived for work at a Pensacola women's clinic 2 years ago today. During Griffin's trial, defense attorneys argued that he was under the influence of Burt. Burt says the wrongful death suit is an attempt to put him out of business because he can't afford to hire an attorney to handle the case. The suit was filed on behalf of Gunn's estate by the Southern Poverty Law Center, a group that has successfully sued the Ku Klux Klan in the past. For National Public Radio, I'm Debbie Elliott reporting.
Another tool of South Africa's apartheid era is going. The financial rand has been abolished. The financial rand, or FinRand, has been used for foreign funding. The commercial rand is used for domestic funding. The Mandela administration is reforming exchange control regulations and getting rid of the dual exchange rate. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 51 points at 4,034. This is NPR. The House has approved the final part of the Republicans' legal reform package. This bill sets limits on punitive damages in all state and federal civil lawsuits at $250,000. These include product liability cases. The bill also caps awards for pain and suffering in medical malpractice suits. The future of this package isn't certain in the Senate. Consumer groups charge the new bill will hurt average customers who won't be able to win fair damages. Colombia is continuing to round up suspected drug dealers. Two children of the world's biggest drug trafficker were detained this morning. Ken Dermata reports from Bogota.
Two children of suspected Cali cartel leader Gilberto Rodriguez Orejuela were arrested near their home, held for questioning, and released. The detention comes less than a week after the arrest of their father's brother, Jorge Rodriguez. He is recognized as a minor trafficker, although he has a pending warrant for drug charges in New York. These arrests are part of Colombia's effort to improve its image as a drug fighter. The Clinton administration came close to cutting off foreign aid on March 1st because it is displeased with Colombian lenience. Local newspapers report the U.S. Embassy is getting tough, too. They say it has revoked visas belonging to relatives of suspected cartel members. For National Public Radio, this is Ken Dermata in Bogota.
Some scientists are warning certain pollutants could be causing a surge in disorders in human reproductive organs. They say exposure to some chemicals in the environment could be related to several disorders like declining sperm counts, increases in breast and prostate cancer. A zoologist from the University of Florida is studying this. He says he found alligators that have mutated sex organs and few male hormones because of pesticide residues. Other scientists say his theory is alarmist and overblown. The government has not tested the effects of the pesticide residues. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, filling in for Terry Gross. A new movie called Outbreak opens today. It's a fictional story about a killer virus that infects people in a small town in California. On the first part of the Friday archive edition of the program, we're going to hear an interview that Terry Gross did about the true story of a lethal epidemic that never happened, but almost did. A rare tropical virus, the Ebola virus, was brought to America through infected research monkeys in 1989. The virus didn't spread to humans, but as one military doctor on the case said, with small changes, this virus could have attacked humans with the infectiousness of influenza and the mortality rate of the Black Plague. Richard Preston first wrote about this virus for The New Yorker. Last October, Terry interviewed him when his book The Hot Zone was first published. A hot zone is an area that contains lethal infectious organisms. There are strains of the Ebola virus that have infected humans. The symptoms are gruesome.
It begins like the flu. You get a headache and a fever, and then your eyes turn bright red, and you begin to get brain damage. People who are infected with Ebola often don't know what has happened to them. This is caused by blood clotting, clots accumulating in the brain as well as in other internal organs in the liver, the intestines, really throughout the body. You have what amounts to a stroke through the entire body. Meanwhile, the rest of the blood loses its ability to clot. It is stripped of its clotting factors. And in the final phase, you go into what military biohazard people call the crash and bleed out. You crash and bleed out. That is to say, you go into shock, and then you die with large amounts of blood streaming from any or all orifices of the body. The blood can come from the nose in the form of a massive bloody nose that won't stop. You can vomit blood. Blood comes from the salivary glands. It comes from the eyes. You can actually weep tears of blood. And then it also comes from the nether regions of the body, from the genitals and from the anus.
It's as if the whole inside of the body liquefies.
Yes. In fact, Ebola virus is an extraordinary virus that attacks virtually all tissues in the human body except for skeletal muscle and bone. It even attacks muscles such as the digestive muscles and the heart. So the heart will have hemorrhages into itself. The heart will actually bleed into itself and then will even flood the chest with blood. There are other aspects to the disease which are quite unpleasant. You can have rips in the skin which appear spontaneously. You can get spontaneous bruises in the face. When the skin is ripped, hemorrhagic blood can pour from the rips. Men and women both can bleed from the nipples. And you get a rather a maculopapular rash that is supposed to look like tapioca pudding. And finally, there are changes to the sex organs of both men and women.
It's as if the body, when it's dying of the Ebola virus, becomes a machine to reproduce the virus because all the blood that's pouring out of every orifice is very contagious with the virus.
Yes, the blood is loaded with virus. In an extreme case, you may have as many as 100 million particles of virus per milliliter of blood. That's a little drop of blood.
How many outbreaks of the Ebola virus have there been around the world?
There haven't been many, thank heavens. There was a rather bad outbreak, a massive outbreak of the strain known as Ebola Zaire in northern Zaire in 1976 along the Ebola River, which runs through rainforest. And about 55 African villages were infected. Not everyone in the villages died. Actually, the attack rate of the virus in the villages was fairly small. Maybe 5 to 10% of the people in the village got it. But those who got it, 9 out of 10 of them died. 9 out of 10 crashed and bled out. It also affected a hospital, the Yambuku Clinic, where apparently it started. And it essentially wiped out the hospital. It killed almost all of the medical staff and almost all of the nuns who were working there.
Well, let's talk about the time this virus came to the United States through research monkeys that were imported from the Philippines to rest in Virginia. How was it discovered that the monkeys who were getting sick, these research monkeys, were actually getting sick with this deadly virus?
Well, they arrived here in a plane load of monkeys from the Philippines. They seemed okay when they came in here, but then after they arrived in this building in Reston, Virginia, where they were being kept for quarantine, very close to the national capital, they began to crash and bleed out here and there. And the veterinarian at the building, Dan Dalgard, obviously had difficulty diagnosing this virus because it's so rare. And he eventually sent some samples to the United States Army, to the United States Army Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, which is located at Fort Detrick in Frederick, Maryland. And there, Army scientists were able to isolate the Ebola virus and characterize it as being definitely Ebola or an Ebola-like strain. And it sent the Army into a full-scale alert. People were really scared. And then there came a very tense time when they were trying to negotiate with the private owners of the building over what to do. And eventually the Army was given permission to go to enter the building and do what had to be done, sterilize it.
The Army researchers entered the building that contained the contagious monkeys, and they had to diagnose the monkeys and then kill the monkeys so that the monkeys couldn't go on to infect either other monkeys or other species. Tell us what they did.
It was, in fact, a military biohazard operation, probably the first one that we know of that the Army has engaged in.
What is a biohazard operation?
A biohazard operation, in this case, was a group of teams. They were mainly soldiers, but there were civilians mixed in, and they were under the command and control of officers. They arrived in Reston in a column of civilian vehicles wearing civilian clothes so that the news media wouldn't spot them. And they parked behind the building, and then for a number of days, they went inside day after day, into a staging room inside the building where they put on biohazard spacesuits and then went through a makeshift airlock into the hot zone, into the area that was known to contain the infective virus.
Now, what are these spacesuits like that researchers have to wear when they're confronting a virus as deadly as Ebola?
Well, there are two basic kinds. There is the portable spacesuit for field biohazard conditions, and then there is the spacesuit which is used in the spacesuit laboratories, which is really a full-scale spacesuit. A lot like a NASA suit. The suit that they were using at the Reston Monkey House was known as a Raycal suit, and it has a pressurized full face, full head air supply with a full body suit that protects you. And it's got blowers which pressurize the suit that keep it under positive pressure so that if the suit gets a rip or a tear, air will flow out of the suit rather than flowing into the suit and potentially contaminating the person inside. So they put these suits on, and then they went through this airlock, went in, carrying a lot of supplies with them. And they killed the monkeys by giving them lethal injections of anesthetic, put them to sleep. I should add that it was probably a better way to die than to die of Ebola virus. And then they put the monkeys into biohazard containers. They were then removed through the airlock of the building. The containers were sterilized on the outside, and then the containers were taken to an ultra-high temperature incineration facility where they were cooked at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, about the temperature of molten steel.
And this was all in an attempt to contain the virus to that monkey house.
Right. And then in addition to that, they also used chemicals on the building. They washed the building with Clorox bleach, as a matter of fact, but they kept washing it till they took the paint right off the concrete. And then they filled the building with fumes and kept it full for 3 days. And by the time they were finished, I think it could be said that nothing lived in that building.
Now, how much had the virus spread from monkey to monkey?
Well, one of the things that really scared officials who were watching this, I would say scared the Army officials, was that they saw that the virus was changing its character inside the building. It was appearing to undergo some kind of drift mutation. We're not sure exactly what was happening, but it did indeed spread through the air conditioning system of the building, and it looked as though it was getting to be more and more of an airborne form. And the monkeys were beginning to look as if they had extremely bad colds. You might call it an Ebola cold, kind of a bloody nose mixed with a lot of mucus coming out of the nose. And four individuals who worked in the building were exposed to the virus and did indeed become infected with it, but they didn't get sick. The virus cleared naturally from their bodies. They're fine now. If they got a headache, they probably didn't notice it. But in any case, they are among the few known survivors of Ebola virus that we know of.
What does it mean that four people would test positive for the virus but not get any symptoms?
Well, there are lots of viruses like that. A lot of viruses, viruses that have no names. You know, you feel lousy for a day or two. And you had some virus, and maybe it's got a name, or maybe it's never come to the attention of science. You know, most viruses don't do a whole lot of damage to their host, because it's not in the best interest of a virus to kill the person or animal that it's living in, because then it can die too. Now, there is an exception to this rule. If the virus can jump along fast enough, if it can move to a new host, then it doesn't really matter what happened to the old host.
So what did we learn from this monkey outbreak in 1980 in Reston, Virginia, about how this virus can or can't jump species?
Well, Ebola is definitely a species jumper. And the Ebola Reston virus, as it is now called, is the only one of those strains that seems to be able to know the difference between a monkey and a human being, between a primate and a person. For some reason, we're not sure why, it didn't go off like a bonfire in Washington. It was as if there was a small genetic change or mutation in that virus that rendered it not quite so infectious or deadly in people. I think of it as being a key that was inserted into a lock, and then the last tumbler failed to click.
What did the military try to do to prevent the press from getting the full scope of the story?
Well, public officials handled the outbreak jointly. The Army worked closely with the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta on many aspects of this outbreak. Together, they did joint press conferences where they basically tried to let the news media know that there was a problem in the building, but they tried to keep it as calm as possible. That's standard operating procedure, by the way. You don't want to panic the population in the early phases of an outbreak. And I can see that point of view. Had I been a journalist on the scene at the time, I'm sure I would have been digging as hard as I could to get the real story. And what the news media missed was they missed the fact that these were military teams, these were soldiers under command of officers, and that they were wearing spacesuits. Of course, if the media had found out about this, for example, if those spacesuits had shown up on television cameras, there would have been a panic in Reston. I mean, if I had seen a thing like that on TV, the first thing I would have done with it would have been to get in my car and get out of town. You would have had huge traffic jams leaving Reston.
Journalist Richard Preston is my guest. His book is called The Hot Zone. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Richard Preston. His new book, The Hot Zone, is about the deadly Ebola virus, which was brought to the United States in 1989 through imported research monkeys. What are the fears now about an outbreak of this virus in the future?
Well, there is a general fear. The problem is that we don't know where Ebola and its cousins live in the rainforest.
What are the theories about where it lives?
The theories are multitudinous. And none of them is perfectly plausible because we know so little about these viruses. Of course, one is that one of the strains lives in some host inside Kitum Cave in East Africa, where I went and explored. There's also, recently I heard a theory that it may be bats. Somebody is convinced that it could be bats. Another possibility I heard recently is that forest dwellers, people who live in the central African rainforest, particularly pygmies, may have a higher rate of incidence of infection of Ebola virus, and it may be something that they are trapping in the forest, maybe some small animal or maybe a large animal. It could also be an insect or an arthropod, a spider, for example. No one really knows.
So no one knows the source of the virus, therefore the virus can't be tracked or stopped. So getting back to what the fears are of a larger outbreak.
Well, the problem is that we don't know what Ebola virus's potential is to break again into the human species. Ebola will be back, but we don't quite know what form it will take. The Ebola resistant strain is still classified as a level 4 agent. That is, you can only handle it with a spacesuit because we know so little about it that government officials are not yet ready to declare that it is safe. On the other hand, so it may come back as something somewhat mild, or it may come back as an airborne killer.
Why do viruses like the Ebola and HIV seem to have originated in the rainforest?
The rainforest is the great reservoir of life on Earth. The bulk of species in this planet live in the rainforest. Viruses are parasites, and they have to live inside something that's alive. And so it stands to reason that viruses, the vast majority of them, would live in the rainforest. Now, what's happening is that there are massive ecological changes going on in the tropical biosphere. Large cities are growing up in and right next to the rainforest. Human transportation is improving. Cultures are changing. Human activities are changing. And meanwhile, viruses are kind of leaking out, as it were. They're coming in contact with the human race. And occasionally you get a slight mutation in a virus from the rainforest that enables it to suddenly break into the human race and keep going. The classic example of that, of course, is the AIDS virus, HIV. Today, scientists think that it probably began its existence as some sort of proto-AIDS virus in chimpanzees. And somehow or other, people came in contact with an infected chimpanzee, and the proto-AIDS virus jumped into a person and then began to move.
One of the things you did for your book is you went to the Kitume Cave in Kenya to get a sense, because there was one theory that this is where the virus was breeding. And so you got a spacesuit and went to this cave and explored around. Why did you do that?
I went to a warehouse in central New Jersey and I bought myself a biological spacesuit. It's amazing what you can find in warehouses in New Jersey. So I flew to Kenya and got a guide, and he took me to Mount Elgon, where Kitume Cave is located. This is in western Kenya, near the border with Uganda. And I went inside the cave and I walked around. Originally, I did this because I wanted to describe some scenes in my book inside Kitume Cave. I have a couple of cases of people who went in there and then later developed this Marburg disease, and terrible things happened to them. So, but after I got there, I realized that it was a fascinating story in its own right. So I explored the cave with the spacesuit on, and I saw a lot of life inside the cave, an amazing amount of life. I had always sort of thought that caves are dark and lifeless places, but not Kitume Cave. It's a place where elephants go. Herds of elephants go inside at night, as many as 75 elephants. And they gather rock inside the cave and chew on it to get the salt out of the rock. They actually scrape the rock off the walls of the cave with their tusks. Now, this is in the African rainforest, and salt is precious in the rainforest, hard to find. So a lot of other animals go inside the cave. Cape buffalo. It's thought that leopards go inside the cave. Lots of different kinds of rodents. And I saw enormous numbers of insects flying out of the cave. It was almost like looking at a snowstorm, snow flying horizontally. And even in the very back of the cave, I found spiders hanging in webs, and they were clearly feeding on something. So there's a lot of life in the cave. And you could describe it as a crossing point, a place where a virus can jump species.
Why? Because there's so many species living there?
Yes. And not only that, the cave is dark. Viruses don't like sunlight. It breaks them apart. And they can't live for very long in direct sunlight. But in a dark, dry, quiet cave, they can live for a fair amount of time, long enough perhaps lying around on a surface to come in contact with a new host, to come in contact with a human being who may be exploring the cave.
So did you feel smart or foolish when you got into this cave?
You should really ask my wife that question. I felt nervous, but I wasn't terribly nervous. I think that the dangers were not terribly great. Plenty of people have gone inside Kitume Cave and not become sick, and they weren't wearing spacesuits. In fact, I interviewed a man who had lived in Katoom Cave for a period of 5 months while he was studying the elephants, and even he didn't get sick. But the problem was that I knew the downside. I knew what crashing and bleeding out is, and I felt that I had to take precautions. So I had a lot of confidence in my equipment as well. I felt that I knew the procedures, and I knew what ought to be done for protection.
I bet when you started writing this book, you didn't expect that the publication of your book would coincide with an outbreak of plague in India.
No, that's eerie. It's very eerie. Fortunately, antibiotics will stop this plague, and it will be stopped. It doesn't represent any threat to us. But it's another example of what can happen in a crowded urban population when an airborne lethal infectious agent begins to move rapidly. And one of the things, of course, that happened in Surat, this western port city in India where it broke out, was that there was a mass panic. Everybody fled out of the city, and they sprayed out all across India. Went to a lot of other cities, and the bacterium, Yersinia pestis, which is the name of the cause of Black Plague, went with them.
Do you want to terrify us with your book? Because it's a pretty scary story. I mean, it has a happy ending. Nobody actually gets the Ebola virus. The monkeys are killed and incinerated, and you know the problem is contained. It's an unfortunate incident that happened years ago, but it's a terrifying incident. And I'm not sure how much you just want to alarm us.
I don't want to scare the bejeebers out of people. That's not the purpose of this book. The purpose of this book, first and foremost, is to tell a very dramatic human story about the lives of real Americans, American lives that many people never even knew existed. I'm a writer, primarily, and what I like is stories. On the other hand, I think there are things that can be done to protect ourselves. I don't want to give people the impression that we are helpless in the face of these level 4 infectious agents. We need better vaccine development in this country. We need better vaccine policy so that we can get those vaccines into our children and into all of us. We need good epidemiology. The CDC is doing a fantastic job of epidemiology here in this country. They're really good at it. But as it turns out, they lack the funds to do good epidemiology abroad. And I've heard CDC officials complaining to me about the fact that they can't even get enough money for an airplane ticket to go to an outbreak in some tropical country. An outbreak that could easily threaten us because of the problem of planes. It could get on an airplane and come here. So we need good epidemiology. And one of the things that has been proposed by the Institute of Medicine, which is a very well-respected group here in Washington, is that there ought to be a chain of jungle research stations around the world that can watch for the emergences of new viruses and new infectious diseases. These would be very cheap to operate. They would be like a distant early warning system. If we had had a jungle research station in Zaire in the mid-1970s, a research station of the right kind, we might have seen the AIDS virus coming. We might have seen it hatching out of the rainforest. And if we had, we might have been able to stop it or slow it down. But because we didn't have a research station of that kind, the world is going to lose anywhere from 10 to 100 million lives, maybe more.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It was nice to be with you, Terry.
Terry Gross interviewed Richard Preston last October. His book about the Ebola virus is The Hot Zone. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowain with Fresh Air. The mystical science of the shaman healers may be in danger of being lost.
Ethnobotanist Mark Plotkin spent time with medicine men in the Amazon basin and discovered the many unique medicinal properties in Amazonian plants. Plotkin fears with the destruction of the rainforest, the shaman's secrets will be destroyed as well. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, a conversation with Plotkin, who wrote about his experiences in Tales from a Shaman's Apprentice. And music critic Milo Miles has found two blues anthologies that will put you back into the peak years with blues master Bobby Blue Bland. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The White House has announced the long-delayed nomination of President Clinton's choice for Agriculture Secretary Dan Glickman will go to the Senate for confirmation hearings starting March 21st. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The nomination of the former congressman from Kansas was held up by a long background check. During the check, there were questions raised about Glickman's use of a campaign credit card. But the White House says the credit card questions are now resolved and that they will not cause a problem for Glickman's confirmation. Glickman would replace Mike Espy, who was forced to resign after it was disclosed he had accepted free travel and sports tickets from a firm with business before the Agriculture Department. The date for Glickman's hearings was set by the Senate Agriculture Committee Chairman Richard Lugar. Lugar says it's necessary to have a Secretary of Agriculture in place because work has already begun on this year's farm bill. Lugar is planning a major revision in farm programs. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Clinton administration's plan to help Mexico is up and running. The Treasury Department says it's releasing $3 billion to help Mexico pay off its short-term government debt. The money is the first installment of the Clinton administration's $20 billion Mexican aid plan. It's designed to stabilize the peso and Mexican financial markets. Michael Jordan took a large step toward returning to professional basketball today. He's announced he's ending his pursuit of a Major League Baseball career. From Chicago, George Offman reports.
He is not a Chicago Bull yet, but he's no longer a member of the Chicago White Sox. Michael Jordan made it official. He's quitting baseball. The former and very possibly soon-to-be basketball star said baseball's current labor dispute has made it increasingly difficult for him to continue his development at a rate which met his standards. Jordan reportedly has told friends and members of the Bulls he will return, and a Chicago TV station claimed Nike shipped 40 pair of Air Jordan shoes to the Bulls practice center. Strong speculation surfaced yesterday Jordan would make his comeback in about 2 weeks. He needs that much time to get in better shape while also trying to negotiate his return. One report said Jordan wants the team to renegotiate both his and Bulls star forward Scottie Pippen's contract. For National Public Radio, I'm George Hoffman in Chicago.
A Texas appeals court has reversed a multi-million-dollar judgment against three makers of breast implants. The 14th Court of Appeals reversed the $29 million judgment at the request of all parties. This clears the way for a smaller but quicker settlement for three Houston-area women. This also erases the verdict against McGann Medical, Inamed Corporation, and 3M. The three women said leaking breast implants caused several illnesses. On Wall Street, stock prices were higher today. The Dow Jones Industrials gained more than 52 points to close at a new record of 4035.61. Advancing issues led decliners by a margin of 8-3 in heavy trading. This is NPR. A Washington state law barring doctors from helping terminally ill patients kill themselves has been upheld by a federal appeals court. Guy Nelson reports from Seattle.
The appeals court says Washington's law protects the poor and handicapped and prevents doctors from killing their patients. That's contrary to a ruling made last May by Seattle federal judge Barbara Rothstein. She said that terminally ill patients are entitled to hasten death through suicide. She compared it to withdrawing life support or a woman's right to an abortion. Members of the Seattle group Compassion in Dying say they're deeply disappointed by the court decision. A spokesperson says the court shows a lack of concern for the terminally ill who are suffering intense pain. Compassion in Dying plans to continue working in Washington and other states to overturn laws prohibiting assisted suicide. Washington would have been the first state in the country to overturn such a law. For National Public Radio, this is Guy Nelson in Seattle.
A plan to store nuclear waste on an Indian reservation in New Mexico has been revived. The Mescalero Apache tribe has voted to resurrect the plan 6 weeks after rejecting it. Tribal leaders ordered a second vote after a petition drive asked them to hold it. Critics claim payments were offered to encourage people to sign the petition. Tribal officials say people changed their minds because they learned more about possible benefits. The vote allows the tribes to reopen talks with some 30 utilities about using Apache land to store spent fuel rods from nuclear power plants. The tribe could get payments of up to $250 million over the 40-year life of the project. Utility crews in Northern California are working against the elements. Storms are still pounding the region, but Pacific Gas and Electric says the number of people without power has fallen to lower than 77,000. Outages reached as many as 633,000 people at the peak of the event. Mudslide watches and flood warnings have been posted around San Francisco Bay. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. For more than 15 years, Mark Plotkin has spent time with the Indians who inhabit the rainforests in the northeast corner of the Amazon basin in South America. The native tribes who live in this lush part of the world depend on the diverse varieties of plants that grow there for food and medicine. Plotkin is an ethnobotanist who has apprenticed himself to the tribal healers to better understand the range of uses of medicinal plants. He's concerned not only about the destruction of rainforest plants, but he's also worried that the knowledge of the tribal healers could be lost as well. Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice is Plotkin's account of his education in the rainforest and his efforts to preserve the wisdom of the tribal healers. It was first published in 1993, and now it's out in paperback. Plotkin currently serves as chief ethnobotanist at Conservation International. He went to some of the finest schools in the States, Harvard, Yale, and Tufts, but he said nothing compares to the education he has received from the shamans and the people in the rainforest.
When we look at the forest, we see a source of green, a source of timber, but when these indigenous peoples look at it, they see a drugstore, a toy store, a perfume store, you name it, and they can make it from rainforest products. And as a drugstore, it's a supermart, it's a Walmart, it's the biggest and the best of everything. You've got treatments there for just about every disease that afflicts our species, and many diseases which haven't arisen yet, and possibly diseases from which we suffer, for which we, as of yet, with Western medicine, have no cure.
Tell us what we use. What is in our medicine cabinet that comes from the rainforest?
Well, recent estimates are about 12% of our prescription drugs come from rainforest plants, and there's many other non-prescription drugs that come from there as well. Curare, used by the Indians as an arrow poison, used by us in Western medicine as a muscle relaxant abdominal surgery, comes from the jungles of the northwest Amazon. Reserpine, which is an important hypotensive agent, that is, it slows down the heart rate or the blood pressure, comes to us from Indian snake root. Many of the things used in the dentist's office, like Novocaine, is actually a synthetic based on cocaine, which comes from Western South America. There's many, many plants out there that already benefit us from the rainforest, and what I think is worth emphasizing is how many more are out there that can benefit us if we protect the forest, if we collect the information on which of these plants are useful from the people who know these plants best.
Tell us how an ethnobotanist works, and that's what and who you are.
Well, an ethnobotanist's job is to work with tribal peoples to find new and useful plants, usually in the tropical rainforest. And every one of us has our own methodologies. I tend to go into the forest with a shaman or a medicine man or a witch doctor, what have you, and with a young member of the tribe. And the young member usually speaks several different languages, which makes it easier to communicate, and also very adept at climbing these trees, which soar into way up into the canopy, 120 feet. And I place myself behind the medicine man and in front of the younger fellow to show the medicine man that I'm there to follow his lead. And also, because we're really the dim country cousins in the big city for the first time, and we're in the rainforest with indigenous peoples, they like to look out for you and keep you in between them so you don't do something stupid like pick up the wrong plant or step on a snake or something that no self-respecting indigenous person, no mistake they'd ever make.
How would you describe their relationship with the forest around them?
Well, I'd say pretty much they're very much a part of the ecosystem, and I mean that as the highest compliment. They are in and of the ecosystem itself. They know the ecosystem better than any university-trained botanist does, and remember that none of these plants were learned of by Harvard or Yale or Cambridge or Oxford-trained botanists. They were all discovered like Columbus discovered America. The Indians got there first. And when they're living their traditional lifestyle, they're part of the ecosystem. But when we go in there with our religion or our technology and begin to disrupt their traditional relationship, with even the best of intentions in many cases, they start to lose their dependence on the rainforest, and that cycle is broken.
Describe for us, if you can, your introduction, and there was a guide you had named Fritz, and it seemed the way you wrote about it that this was really your first introduction into the rainforest, where the job was to try to understand the plants that were all around you.
Well, Fritz von Thrun is the greatest botanist I've ever met. This is a barely literate man of a Maroon tribe, which is a tribe of Afro-Americans. These were Africans brought to the Amazon in the 17th and 18th century to be slaves on the sugar plantations. These guys took one look around and said, hey, this is equatorial rainforest, we'll see you white boys later, and took off for the interior where they maintain what are essentially West African tribal lifestyles to the current day. And Fritz von Thrun, it sounds like a good Dutch name.
Yeah,
I expected
sure
this little Dutch boy with a page boy haircut and wooden shoes, and here was this huge, muscular Afro-American man who turned out to know more about botany than I could ever hope to learn.
Well, describe for us how he took you into the forest and how he related to the plants around him.
Well, he took me into the forest and began to show me the many uses they have for plants, not just medicines, but drinks, but vines to make ropes or hammocks, plants used by his ancestors to survive when they'd escaped into the jungle to escape the overseers. And it was really an eye-opener because I began to see that this wasn't something just beautiful, but really something that could provide all the sources to make life possible.
Well, I got the feeling, the way you wrote, that every step of the way was, at least for you, this whole new drugstore, if we can use that again, of plants. And around the next corner was a whole other one.
Every step into the rainforest the first time was a revelation, because every few feet there'd be a medicine or a fiber or an essential oil or some sort of useful plants. And it just showed me how, with my Western education being turned loose in the rainforest, I was just in a sea of green. But with an indigenous or a semi-indigenous guide, all of a sudden you understand how to use the forest, how these things can benefit us, and it makes you appreciate not only the potential of these species which are being lost, but the importance of the knowledge of these species, which really exists in the heads of the men and women who know the forest best.
What kinds of sicknesses do people get who, the indigenous tribes who live in the rainforest?
Well, of course, the great tragedy of these introduced diseases, for which they often have no cure. Now, you give these guys another 20,000 years, and maybe they can find the cure for the common cold, but they haven't had 20,000 years to find plants against it, only 500 years since it's been introduced. But nonetheless, I think a very important point worth underlining is that the greatest scourge in human history is malaria. Malaria has killed more people than any other two diseases combined, and the frontline drug for malaria is quinine, which comes from Western South America. Now, quinine was first discovered and taught to us by the South American Indians. So they did, in those 500 years, find the cure to the greatest disease from which people have ever suffered.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is ethnobotanist Mark Plotkin. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mark Plotkin. He's an ethnobotanist and the author of a book called Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice. How does one become a shaman?
Well, traditionally, it varies from culture to culture and tribe to tribe. And with the Tirios, which is the tribe that I know best, you had to apprentice yourself to the medicine man. It was often the son of the medicine man, or it was somebody who had to volunteer or was chosen by the medicine man. You had to undergo 4 years of training, which is equivalent to a university education. You had to go through certain dietary restrictions. You had to put up with certain sexual restrictions. You then had to take a very hallucinogenic plant to commune with the spirit world. And then you had to learn which plants and which chants could be used to cure people.
What position do they hold then within the local society?
Well, traditionally, the two paramount positions in this tribe were the chief and the medicine man. But with the advent of missionary activity, the medicine man has been very much discredited, because with the introduction of introduced medicines, which are highly effective against introduced diseases, and with an introduced religion, some of these people had a vested interest in saying the medicine man was really a person from the past who had no role in the future of these societies. So you still have the chief, and in many of these villages, you still have the medicine men. But in a lot of cases, the medicine men are dying out, and that's where the race comes in to save this information before it irretrievably disappears.
It seems that a lot of the kind of medicine that is being done in the Amazon rainforest really mixes ceremony with healing. Is that something that you've thought about and even thought about what might be missing in the American form of medicine?
A colleague of mine who's a medical anthropologist, said that Western medicine often cures, but it doesn't heal. And I think what he means by that is this holistic approach to healing, which involves treating all aspects of the patient. So it's not just this magic bullet approach, which I think Western medicine has been obsessed with for quite some time. And I believe that indigenous healers who've been using things like visualization, massage, aromatherapy for thousands and thousands of years, would find it highly ironic when Western medicine starts discovering things like visualization and massage and aromatherapy. So I believe that there are a lot of things we can learn from these people. First and foremost, new therapeutic compounds, but perhaps attitudes towards treating patients as well.
Tell us what these indigenous peoples can learn from Western medicine.
Well, in Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice, I point out that there are medicines that we have that they don't have, which are effective for diseases which can really devastate an entire tribe. Things like mumps or measles, or basic treatments for the common cold, at least when they're bacterial in origin, and other things which have come in there which they couldn't treat because they haven't had long enough time to find a plant that can cure it. I believe that plants can cure just about any ailment, I won't say all of them, and some of these things we've introduced and we've developed very effective treatments for.
Well, you've been an ethnobotanist for more than a decade now. What plants have you been able to gather? And tell us what, as you've brought them back to the States here, if they've been made in any particular kinds of medicines or where that has taken medical research in this country.
Well, I've sat on my plants for the better part of a decade. I didn't want to turn it over to a pharmaceutical company which was going to find the cure for X, Y, or Z, synthesize it, make zillions of dollars, and leave the poor Indians in the dust. And as a result of this, there's been another groundswell in the ethnobotanical community to realize this type of cut-and-run approach is no longer viable. And a group of people got together and set up a company called Shaman Pharmaceuticals in the San Francisco area, which is predicated on the idea that not only are we going to find new and useful drugs from indigenous peoples, which in fact we have, but that a percentage of the proceeds should flow back to indigenous peoples, first and foremost, to the countries from which these plants come from, particularly these tropical countries, and into rainforest conservation as a whole. And now we at Conservation International, the environmental organization with which I work, are now brokering an agreement between indigenous peoples in the Northeast Amazon, the national government of Suriname, and a major pharmaceutical firm to do just this sort of thing, which is to make sure that we are using ethnobotany as a guide and that make sure that a percentage of the profits go back to these peoples.
Tell us about an old football wound of yours, and this is something that has really dogged you for a lot of your adult life.
Well, fortunately, it doesn't dog me anymore,
right?
Because the medicine man cured it. I was living next to a gymnasium when I was in forestry school at Yale, and I guess I had a few too many hormones in my system at the time. I started lifting weights every day. So I damaged my elbow, what they called chronic tendonitis, which is a great diagnosis, except they couldn't cure it. So they gave me ultrasound, they gave me ice water baths, nothing happened. Then I went off to Harvard as a researcher and got this top-notch physician who made the same diagnosis and pumped me full of steroids. Not only did that not make me better, it hurt like hell. So finally I was down in Wayana country, and I found this great Wayana medicine man. And after collecting plants with him a few days, I was sufficiently impressed by his abilities as a healer to say, look, grandfather, you know, I've got this terrible problem with my elbow. Do you think you can treat it? Well, the guide, who was a young Wayana, said, hey, he says, look, he says, don't test this guy. He says, you know, this is a very serious and a very dangerous man. He says, I hope you're not doing this to test this guy because this could get you in a lot of trouble. If you've got an injury, he can heal it, but don't be playing games with him. I said, I assure you, this is somebody that I would not be playing with. So the fellow brought me through an entire curing ceremony, building a hut of palm thatch in the jungle, treating me with tobacco smoke, magic herbs, chants, and it hasn't bothered me since.
When you're sick in the United States, what do you do for the sort of everyday illnesses, the fevers, the headaches, the earaches?
Well, I can't answer that in any one way because it depends on the illness and depends on where I am. Because there are things that I go to the physician for. If I have acute appendicitis, I want to be treated by a surgeon. But if I have a fungal infection of the skin, I wait till I get back in the rainforest and use the plants that the indigenous peoples have taught me. I've had stomach ailments coming out of the fact that I've had parasites so many damn times, which Western physicians really couldn't treat successfully. So I went to a fellow who was practicing Chinese medicine, and he cleared me right up. I mean, the point, again, is that no system has all of the answers, and you have to be willing to experiment and try different systems to find what may be best for you.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ethnobotanist Mark Plotkin's book, Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice, is now out in paperback. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about the show today. So, Noah, what's going on in Washington?
Hi, Marty. The House has approved the final part of the legal reform legislation. Among other things, this bill would limit the damage awards from a company if a product proves faulty. Other stories, Alan Greenspan of the Federal Reserve Board and Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin speaking on Capitol Hill, defending the Clinton administration's economic rescue plan for Mexico. Also, memories of the Memphis writer Peter Taylor and a conversation with Nashville songwriter Gary Burr. These are from Linda Wertheimer, our colleague, who is reporting this week from Nashville, Tennessee.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Blues revivals come and go, but they usually select particularly romantic loners to revive. Music critic Milo Miles says Tennessee native Bobby Blue Bland is a blues master who doesn't fit the outsider image. Bland began as a pal of B.B. King and Johnny Ace, but had no success until several years after they were established. Milo has this review of two recent CD collections that cover Bland's long career.
Love and affection, a heart so true, are yours for the asking. I've got it all right here for you.
Bobby Blue Bland should be as famous as B.B. King. Well, that's probably too much, but it's certainly a bitter shame that Bland remains a big cult star and not synonymous with sophisticated urban blues. Certainly his voice can be the equal of any instrument that ever played the music. He had scads of hits on the black charts in his peak years from 1957 to 1964 or so, but he almost never crossed over. It didn't help that he recorded for an indie label as exploitative as any, but maybe the real problem is that you just can't reduce Bobby Bland to a one-line legend. Complex as it is, his appeal is enormous.
Without a warning, you broke my heart. You took it, darling, and you tore it apart. You left me sitting in the dark crying. You said your love for me was dying. I'm begging you, baby, baby, please. I'm begging you, baby, baby, please. Turn on the light, let it shine on me. Turn on your love light, let it shine on me. Let it shine, 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 let it shine.
Bland has always had a lot of his prime work in circulation, but the most sumptuous reissues ever made are the double CDs called I Pity the Fool and Turn On Your Love Light. Bland absolutely inhaled a mob of influences that appealed to him. He's considered blues, but he's no stranger to soul and pop. He intensified the ballad emoting of white crooners like Tony Bennett. He turned the sermon roars of the Reverend C.L. Franklin into a squall of secular excitement. Still, picking out the sources of Bland's style is really beside the point. You can hear the inspirations without ever feeling he's an imitation. In a way, hefty Bobby Bland's closest parallels are Barry White and Heavy D. They're all hulking love men who sweet-talk women and build passion one caressed note at a time. Call it the grand tradition of the unstuds. Bland overwhelms at mid-tempo or slower as he opens up wells of despair and abandonment ordinary sufferers can't even imagine. The old line is that blues guys treat women like devils and soul guys treat them like angels. Bland treats lovers like mean angels. His basic cry might be, "Why hast thou forsaken me?"
Nobody cares about me. I ain't even got a friend. Baby's going to left me. When will my troubles end? Black night is falling. Oh, I hate to be alone. I keep crying for my baby, and now another day is gone.
Rock fans often praise Bland for rough early numbers like It's My Life, Baby, and I Woke Up Screaming, and Further Up the Road. But I don't know, is there all that representative of his work? The wonder of I Pity the Fool and Turn on Your Love Light is how determined, how unerring Bland and his group were, session after session. Bland still makes records and performs. His Rasping Squall was once a vehicle of glory and terror, but these days it sounds more like an enormous burp. He'll hit retirement age this year and deserves to coast a little. It's anyone who hasn't discovered Bland that has to get to work. Although I Pity the Fool has about as many hits as Turn on Your Love Light, Bland's manner is fully formed on the second anthology. You just have to take a step toward Bobby Blue Bland. He'll come to you the rest of the way.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. Our engineers this week were Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, and Richard Parker. Alan Tu directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.
Wow, baby, come on and let's talk it time. Well, I'm tired of being abused. I'm tired of feeling low. I'm gonna have myself some fun, and I won't wanna worry no more, cause I'm gonna play the high class junks. I'm gonna play the low class junks. Well, and baby, I'm gonna even play the honky tonk. Well, I've always been true, I never told you a lie. No matter what I'd say, Lord, I just can't satisfy. I'm gonna play the high class joints. I'm gonna play.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, futurists Alvin and Heidi Toffler discuss their comeback. The two say they felt snubbed by American academics as crystal ball gazers. But now, thanks to Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich, a Toffler devotee, they're becoming GOP gurus. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.